This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Politicians inject race into their speeches all the time, but they do it in ways that give them an out if they're accused of racism. Coded phrases like welfare queen, illegal alien, and thug send clear messages to their intended audience without using epithets that are unacceptable in public discourse. Some call it dog whistle politics. As the presidential campaign accelerates, we're taking a moment to examine the ways that language shapes political speech about race. We'll talk about that and more in this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. And joining me always is Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University, the author of many books, and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark. Good day.
How
are
you doing, Frank?
Good. Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, also an Emmy-nominated film producer and filmmaker. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
Also joining us today is Ian Haney-Lopez. He's a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley and the author of the book Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Ian, welcome. Good to have you here.
Terrific. Very pleased to join you.
Well, let me start with you. Give us a brief description of dog whistle politics and kind of a fuller picture of how this works in the contemporary scene.
So dog whistle politics is a metaphor. If you think about a literal dog whistle, it's a whistle that blows at such a high frequency that human ears can't hear it, but dogs can. So this is a metaphor for political speech that's operated on two levels. On one level, silent, but on another, designed to provoke sharp reactions. And in the racial context, the terms that you mentioned earlier, illegal alien, thug, welfare queen, you can see how they're operating as dog whistles. When you look at the surface of them, none of them say race. Where's black? Where's brown? And yet, just underneath, think about the imagery that these terms evoke. These are designed to provoke sharp racial reactions. You may think of several other terms too, because it's not just terms that are used to bring to mind people of color. You can think of terms like silent majority or real Americans or tax-paying Americans or the heartland. These terms too are operating as dog whistles with a racial subtext.
They're pointing out you're suggesting that you, the real Americans, meaning you white middle-class Americans, right, this sort of thing. And
right.
You're supposed to know that as the audience. At what level, Ian, do you think this operates consciously on the part of that audience? I mean, why speak in code?
So I think that it's very important to speak in code precisely because the way in which our country is evolving around race. Nobody wants to think, or very few people want to think of themselves as out-and-out racist. There's an interesting poll that just came out among Donald Trump supporters in South Carolina. Among that group, something like 16% said that they believe whites are a superior race. Now, that's an astoundingly high number. But it's also true then that the vast majority of Donald Trump supporters do not expressly endorse the idea that whites are superior. And yet they're responding to a political rhetoric that triggers, and I think it's important, on an unconscious sort of subterranean level, a sense that, in fact, whites are superior, that this is fundamentally a white country, that whites are endangered by the surging immigration from Latin America and from beyond Europe generally, that there is this racial threat of terror, not just in the Middle East, but in terms of the Muslim presence and Sharia law in the country. Right? So they're responding to a coded narrative that suggests that whites are endangered, that whites are decent and hardworking, but under threat. And yet very few of these folks would endorse or support a politician who stood up and frontally said, I'm here to represent the interests of the endangered, embattled white man.
So let's see how this is playing out, Mark and Natalie. Mark, I'll start with you. How do you hear this playing out in the current debate, in the presidential campaign?
Well, I think when you think about Trump and the kind of things that get set in motion, you know, with folks who are there following him, you know, attacking, you know, black protesters or whenever there are black protesters there, folks who are critical of Trump and they're being jettisoned out of the space. I think a lot of those folks, I think, you know, he's right. You know, a lot of these folks would not think of themselves as racist. But part of it is also the public performance of what we think of as racism. You know, and the ways that folks might have prejudices and beliefs, and as long as they remain internal and insular and private, that's very different than someone representing those politics explicitly publicly. And they're always going to reject that. I mean, that's the whole rationale behind dog whistle politics.
And I think it's interesting that Trump, you know, he probably is the least, he knows exactly what he's doing. So I won't say that he's not savvy, but he's really not speaking in code most of the time. But the part of it that to me is kind of harkens back to this idea of dog whistle politics is that he won't be accountable for anything he says. So it's as if he never said it. And that is, to me, at the heart of, you know, what Dr. Lopez is talking about, this ability to say certain things and they resonate with a certain group. But you can act as though, you know, you never said anything that is offensive or insulting.
And it may be true that Donald Trump is the least coded of politicians that we've heard in a long, long time. And lest you think that this only happens on the Republican side, Hillary Clinton is also accused of using this. We'll take you back to 1996 when she used this phrase.
Not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
There we go. That's Hillary Clinton in 96. She's defending the crime bill that her husband Bill Clinton had pushed through Congress. My guests are pop culture experts Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, and also law professor Ian Haney Lopez. Mark, there's another clear example of that kind of language.
You know, the super predator thing is important, obviously, because we're talking about it now in the political context at the moment. But, you know, in many ways, she's riffing off a narrative that had been built going back to the Central Park Five, right? And the idea that there are bands of black kids roaming around Central Park wildin', you know, which of course is a reference to a rap song. So she's really building off of that kind of narrative, right? And there's a historical period, right, where you just mentioned the term wilding, right? And, you know, young youth wilding in the park, and immediately you're thinking about young black hip-hop kids acting crazy and criminal, right? And she's kind of buying into that whole narrative when she uses the term super predator. They're not just gangs anymore, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, and we talked about Donald Trump. Where do you think he fits in Haney Lopez? Is he less coded? I mean, he seems to be much less careful about how he uses language. How do you frame him in this debate?
I think he's both less coded, but still quite careful. So I think it becomes very important to make a distinction between the different sorts of racism that we're talking about. I think most people think of racism in the sort of Klan,
burning
a cross,
crosses, yeah.
That sort of thing.
White supremacy. Right?
So
yeah.
White supremacy, but it's an expression of racism that is overt, that is malevolent, that is tied very closely to violence. And if that's the only form that racism takes, then we can all comfortably say we're not racist and our society is largely beyond racism. But in fact, what you see with many of the Trump supporters is that there's a powerful cultural racism that's going on, or a routine racism that suggests to people at the notion of unexamined assumptions that white people are decent and hardworking, that people of color are dark and dangerous and foreigners, and that whites are under assault. That's the sort of routine, pervasive racism that dog whistle politics speaks to. But what about the politicians, the people like Donald Trump? I would describe that as a form of strategic racism. It's strategic in the sense that they've made the purposeful decision that they can win votes, gain support, manipulate people by pandering to their racial fears. And that is just at root cold-hearted strategy. And I think that Trump has long played this game. He was actually one of the leading outspoken instigators of the racial panic about the Central Park Five,
right.
And took out an ad to make that point. I think he knows very much what he's doing. Now, at the same time, I think he is less coded. He is far more bold and blatant in what he says. But I want to suggest that he's still coded in this way. When he talks about Mexicans, for example, he makes it clear that he's talking about a national origin group. Or when he talks about Muslims, this is about religion. But you almost never hear Trump use words like white, brown, black, let alone a racial epithet. Mm-hmm. He understands that to preserve his appeal to his supporters, he can't go that far and just use express racial terms, let alone racial epithets.
And he has to assume that his listeners are not going to be critically judging the content of his speech. Let's listen to this.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
I mean, to make a blanket statement like that, uncritically, you know, sort of about all of the Mexicans, with the exception of the some, who he doesn't name, but I'm sure he's got a list, you know, suggests that he doesn't think much of the thought process that his audience is going through.
So I think that what he's doing, I think he's actually thinking deeply about how his audience is thinking. It has since emerged that he had an associate listen to months and months of Fox News and Fox programming, and to try and distill central themes out of that world. That's the world that his audience is coming from. And what Trump has recognized is he can generate tremendous support by speaking to a set of anxieties about undocumented immigrants, about Mexicans, and the sort of generic Mexican, about Muslims, to a certain extent about blacks, and that he can combine these with the other pervasive anxiety in the lives of many whites, which is economic anxiety.
I'll tell you what, we're going to explore that more fully in just a minute. We're going to take a break right now and be back to the state of things. Stay with us on Back Channel. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio with Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Also with us, Ian Haney Lopez, a law professor at UC Berkeley and the author of the book Dog Whistle Politics. We're all here for Back Channel, connecting culture and context. And today we're talking about coded language about race in the media and certainly in political campaigns. Ian, just before the break, you were talking about the anxieties that this speaks to, the idea that there's something that's troubling those voters who go to these rallies, but it may not be precisely what they're talking about. Talk about these sort of latent and buried anxieties.
Well, I think if you think about where most whites are in this country, there are two overwhelming anxieties that people face. And I would say first and foremost is the economic one. Indeed, when you look at polls of Trump supporters, the number one issue that people cite when they explain why they support Donald Trump is economic anxiety. And I think we can completely understand where that's coming from. There's been a massive shift of wealth from the middle class, from the working class to the rich. People have lost their jobs. They've lost their pensions. They've lost their homes. So there's tremendous fear and uncertainty there in terms of the people's present reality, in terms of the future, in terms of their children. At the same time, the country has changed remarkably in the last 50 years, let's say since the civil rights movement. And we should be very clear about the nature of this change. The United States as a country emerges out of an ideology of white supremacy that justifies the dispossession of Native Americans, the enslavement of African Americans, westward expansion, the taking of the northern half of Mexico. This is part of our heritage. What you see in the 1960s is an effort to turn away from that, to reject white supremacy as a guiding principle in our society. And it was measured in terms of formal equality for African Americans and also reforms to our immigration law that began to allow immigrants from beyond Europe. We're living with that legacy now. We are in the midst now, today, of a transition away from a country founded on notions of white supremacy to a country that is truly a multiracial democracy. And yet in the midst of that transition, it has created anxiety among many whites about the nature of that change and about the perceived erosion of status of whites.
Well, and coincidentally, that occurs at the same time that we see a tremendous transfer of wealth beginning in the 1970s from the middle and lower classes to a vanishingly thin layer of society. And as that wealth vanishes from their pockets, we also feel these cultural changes. And the instinct would be then to blame the cultural change on the fact that I now, as a middle-class white American, have fewer privileges than I thought that I had in the 1950s. Natalie?
Well, I'm thinking about the fact that there are African Americans that support Trump, right? And if there is a group of, as I understand, there's a group of middle class white Americans who see African Americans as the problem. We're the ones who took jobs and all of these things. And then it's interesting to me that African Americans who feel like Trump's message resonates with them seem to jump on the bandwagon because of the way he talks about Mexicans, the way he talks about other immigrants who then we think are our problem because now they've taken jobs away from us. And so the layers of this thing is just so interesting because, you know, at the end of the day, what Professor Lopez is talking about, this shift where we're really heading towards a diverse country, a diverse cultural makeup in this country, we're all fighting it. It seems like, you know, all of us are looking for someone to blame, but the reality is when you look at power and who actually has the power to deal with the economic disparity.
Who took the $1 trillion
Thank
from
you.
Me?
That's right, exactly.
It really wasn't welfare. Exactly. Believe me, we didn't spend $1 trillion on welfare or food stamps. Spent $1 trillion on tax change that allowed American corporations to amortize their wealth and their capital early so that they could invest abroad, sell jobs overseas, right, and those same workers then reelected the guy who did it to him.
Right.
And but Mark Anthonino, also, I want to get back to how this trick works, because the idea is that you have to have a cultural referent. In other words, for there to be a code, a certain body of language, as you pointed out, you know, the idea of super predator has to make, there have to be these cultural reference that everybody gets for the code to work.
I mean, the best example, of course, is the most timeless one, you know, Ronald Reagan and the idea of a welfare queen. And that's so embedded in our imagination, our national imagination, that you can get rid of the welfare piece. So that when we think about when Lonnie Guineers put up for confirmation, what is she described as? She's described as the quota queen, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a direct reference to the Reagan moment, right? And again, this kind of trafficking in the cultural history that folks in the 1990s would go, oh yeah, right, this is a black woman, mm-hmm, right? You know, just like the, because, you know, Reagan never said she was a black woman, but we heard welfare queen, we just immediately assumed what she looked like and where she lived and what have you.
Yeah, well, and this is an interesting point, and you make a connection here, Ian Haney Lopez, between the kind of racial reference that we're talking about and the connection between government programs that were successful in the New Deal and that Lyndon Johnson had. Let's talk about Lyndon Johnson and the turning point for the Republican Party in 1964 and the way in which government programs became connected with minorities, and the two were disparaged in a single breath. Talk about that for us.
So I think that it's very important to make this connection. You know, you said earlier that people are going to respond almost instinctively as they lose jobs, but also see the racial composition of the country changing, to connecting the two and blaming minorities for job loss. I think that there is a grassroots element, a sort of a common sense element. But much more importantly, this was the strategy of the very rich. This was the strategy of business elites. So the business elites, if you think about business elites in the New Deal era, this was a period of sort of the biggest expansion of the middle class the country had ever seen. But it was also a period of regulation of the marketplace, support for unions, high levels of taxation. For people, for the business elites opposed to those sorts of things, how could they get the country as a whole to vote against them when they were so obviously beneficial to the country as a whole? And it turned out they got an opening through the New Deal. Through the Civil Rights Movement. The New Deal coalition had been made up of the white working class across the country, Northeastern elites, and also African Americans. With the Civil Rights Movement, it created the opportunity to drive a wedge between this coalition and to say to the white working class, your real enemy is not the business elite. It's not the bosses. Your real enemy are the blacks who are moving into your schools, moving into your neighborhoods. And this ended up working. And so the right develops a very basic narrative line. It says, fear people of color. Hate government because government refuses to control these people through lax criminal law and forces their integration on you. And as long as you hate government, trust instead the marketplace. So cut taxes for the rich because they're the job creators and get government out of the way of regulation. Instead, let corporations write their own regulation. You can trust the marketplace. And all of these social programs like education and investment in infrastructure and investment in cities, slash all of that. Cut all of that spending because that's really wasted spending for undeserving minorities. And these are the policies that have actually driven the massive redistribution of wealth from all of us to the very rich.
This may sound like some grand conspiracy theory, but I do think you would acknowledge that it happened in stages. The business community, as you say, right at the New Deal said, we're in trouble. Business regulation and tax programs actually help people. And if people figure this out, they're going to keep taxing us and regulating us. So they create the Council on Public Relations. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce works overtime to start to convince America that it's business and not government that's going to make your life. Then they get their real opening. The political connection, and I love the way you talk about this, happens in 1964 when this connects itself to a political party. First, I want to play this ad from Lyndon Johnson's very successful campaign in 1964. Let's listen to this clip.
Today, millions of American families are caught in circumstances beyond their control. Their children will be compelled to live lives of poverty unless the cycle is broken. President Johnson's war on poverty has this one goal, to provide everyone a chance to grow and make his own way. A chance at education. A chance at training. A chance at a fruitful life. Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
And vote they did. Landslide victory over Barry Goldwater. The Republican Party sees the success of that appeal and the Democratic Party, and they have to change. Tell us what happens next, Ian. Because I think that quote from Robert Novak, who then pulls himself, who is reporting on the a meeting of the Republican leadership, is critical to this conversation.
Yeah, so this is an amazing moment. This is Lyndon Johnson campaigning for president, saying to the country, we have the authority, we have the ability to end poverty. Let's end poverty by the bicentennial. And he wins in a landslide. And this really suggests the way in which the country is fundamentally believes in the power of government to make the lives of all of us better. And yet, simultaneously, Barry Goldwater and the Republicans have been using racial themes. They've been campaigning on a set of dog whistles about the threat of integration. And they've been talking about states' rights, and they've been talking about freedom of association. And they're doing so because in the summer of 1963, they had made the fateful decision that they could use race as a wedge issue to begin to win votes. And in fact, Robert Novak, a conservative columnist, had attended a meeting of the Republican National Committee in Denver in the summer of 1963. And he came out of that meeting and he wrote, a great many of the party's leaders, perhaps a majority, believe there's substantial political gold in the racial crisis to becoming the white man's party in fact, though not in name. And this is incredible moment. This is not racism on the part of the GOP, not racism in the hate every black person, white supremacist sense. This is racism in the strategic sense. They are going to use race, but they're going to use it in code because this is the height of the civil rights movement. You just can't come out and say anymore expressly, we are the white man's party.
Natalie,
the code again.
Yeah.
Let me just finish this, because
sure.
This is states' rights and freedom of association. and Goldwater. He loses across the country, but not in the five southern states with the largest African-American population. And this was the proof of concept. You could use race to convince whites to abandon the Democratic Party and to vote for conservatives who promised to dismantle the New Deal if you did so in racial terms.
Because the Democrats had been the white man's party in the South. And so the clear message here, as you suggest, is that they would actually change party affiliation as long as you did what Southern Democrats were doing. You were the white man's party.
Precisely.
Yeah. Natalie.
Well, I'm just, it's so fascinating. I'm thinking that, you know, the issues around HB2 in our state and, I mean, and I guess it's throughout the South, really.
Yeah, right.
It's like, you know, this is the new dog whistle, this idea of protecting us from all the rest of us, from these different people, from transgender people, from LGBT people. You know, there is no difference, really. And so I think this is just, you know, instructional to what's going on right now.
How do you think that plays, Ian Haney Lopez, the idea of HB2? Because it also, for local control, that one takes it on the nose, obviously, because you've thumped a local city's right to protect other people's rights and said, no, we're not protecting those rights here because we have another constituency that we have to sort of toot it out. Do you think this plays into that same narrative?
Oh, absolutely. And I think both of you have made really terrific points. This is not about local control. Local control is a dog whistle that says, hey, we want to resist integration, but we can't come out and say we're against mixing with black people, so we're going to say we're in favor of local control. On the other hand, if it turns out it's local control that means protection from discrimination for the transgender community, then actually we don't care about local control at all, right? And now this other concept that this is a new sort of dog whistle, I think that that's precisely right. What is happening here is that business interests have developed a political rhetoric that says to working people, the biggest threat in your life comes from other working people. It comes from other working people who somehow are dragging down your status as a white person, as a straight person, as someone who's male, someone who's Christian, someone who believes in traditional family roles. They're saying to folks, worry about other working people who are degrading your status, who are undercutting and disrespecting you. Don't worry about the bosses. Don't worry about the corporations. Don't worry about the very rich who increasingly are almost international in their orientation. They're simply disconnected from the lives of the rest of us in their gated communities, in their private jets.
Well, and again, these are sort of sophisticated theories. So I can imagine you in your car listening to this, wondering how this grand conspiracy can come together. But it doesn't act as a conspiracy. And I think this is one of the interesting things. These interests tend to play together. And here's Ronald Reagan's advisor. This is a 1981 interview. Lee Atwater, who's President Ronald Reagan's advisor. And he's talking very directly about making this switch quite consciously, quite openly. The audio quality is not very good. He uses the N-word, and we're not going to bleep him because you really need to hear the whole thought process and his language, I think. So we're not going to bleep him, and I apologize for the quality. Here's Lee Atwater in 1981, Ronald Reagan advisor.
Start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than white.
So we're not making this stuff up, Mark Anthony.
No, we're not making this stuff up. And of course, when Lee Atwater was at his best, for lack of a better way to describe it, you know, we get the Willie Horton ads, you know, which become a kind of visual dog whistle, right, about how the Democrats were, and Michael Dukakis in this case, would be soft on crime. And again, Willie Horton is the super predator that Hillary Clinton is referencing, you know, eight years later. Right.
Well, and I want to talk about the way this has moved left, because you talk about this as well, Ian, the fact that we've talked a lot about Republicans. We've mentioned Hillary, but I'm going to take you back to 1996 now. And Bill Clinton and the way in which the Democratic Party had to respond to the success of the Republicans in their strategy. Let's listen to Bill Clinton talk about welfare reform.
Today we have an historic opportunity to make welfare what it was meant to be, a second chance, not a way of life. And even though the bill has serious flaws that are unrelated to welfare reform, I believe we have a duty to seize the opportunity it gives us to end welfare as we know it.
1996, President Bill Clinton, Ian Haney Lopez, what happened to the Democratic Party? They took notes, I guess.
They absolutely took notes. And this really goes to your point about this not being a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy in the sense that nobody in 1964 sat down and mapped out what would happen over the next 50 years. Nevertheless, there's a lot of thoughtfulness and learning that has gone into this. These are folks saying to themselves, how do I exercise power? Now, for the very rich, that's how do I cut my taxes? How do I gain control of government? For politicians, it's how do I get elected? And so what happens with the Democrats is they see that race is being used successfully as a wedge issue against them. And by 1992, they've learned the perverse lesson, best summarized in the phrase, if you can't beat them, join them. And so Bill Clinton begins to campaign this phrase so that welfare becomes so the welfare is no longer a way of life. That's out of his 1992 campaign, where he also promised to crack down on crime. Cracking down on crime, ending welfare as a way of life. Those were coded racial themes used by Republicans. The Democrats pick them up, too. And what you've had, and this really has driven racialized mass incarceration of the sort that Michelle Alexander talks about in the new Jim Crow. Right. This really comes out of a competition between Republicans and Democrats to win over white swing voters by proving which of those two parties can be tougher, more violent, more oppressive towards the African-American community.
I'm going to take a break right here and be back with our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, talking about coded language on Back Channel today. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. On Back Channel today, our special guest is Ian Haney Lopez, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. And with us, as always, on Back Channel, Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. So before the break, we were talking about the fact that these various interests come together in ways that support this kind of racially coded language. Mark Anthony Neal, and you point out that it's not even Democrats and Republicans, but African-American candidates and politicians are using this language as well.
I mean, last summer when we had or last spring, you know, when Freddie Gray's death occurred, and of course things are crazy, a little crazy in Baltimore. You have Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who's the mayor of Baltimore, black woman, who references, you know, the protesters as thugs. And it functions that same kind of way, right? Because if you're a black mayor of a major urban city, you know, the people that you always have to sell over and over again is a white business community, and the white business community needs to know that there's going to be law and order, and the protesters are disrupting that, so the protesters become thugs. We see the same thing with President Obama at various times around Ferguson, you know, the use of the terms like thugs and hoodlums, right? It's very coded language about, you know, black folks who follow the law mm-hmm. and black folks who don't.
Yeah. So this one. So how careful do they have to be? I mean, does context matter? Do I have to pay attention to who I am? If I'm a Republican, can I be a little more careless in my use of the language? And do I have to put it in a deeper context to suggest that there are certain thugs among this group and not everybody's a thug? How does that work?
I actually think politicians are very, very careful wordsmiths. You know, I mean, and we know this about politicians. This is what we mean when we say somebody's being political or a politician. That they're not likely saying precisely what they mean. So, in this sense, I think what you see is politicians who are thinking about which audience is most likely to hold them accountable. And so, this business about, for example, black politicians using thug. If they're not used to, if the African-American community hasn't been mobilized, hasn't put a lot of political pressure on them, they really are then speaking to the white business interests. On the other hand, once the African-American population becomes mobilized, it's very costly now to use that old sort of language. And now politicians find themselves caught. And I think this is one of the tremendous accomplishments of Black Lives Matter as a movement. because now you have part of a resurgent activist tradition within the African-American community that is starting to hold politicians to account, including politicians on the left, saying to them, we need to hear you. We need to hear you speak to racial justice issues. You can no longer simply pander to white voters. You need to speak directly to the concerns of the black community. And this is a tremendous and potentially game-changing phenomena in the 2016 campaign.
Mark and Natalie, do you think then that this suggests that this kind of exposure, that by showing the man behind the curtain, to some extent you can defuse or neutralize this kind of language or the effect of this kind of language?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that there's the potential for that sort of diffusion, but I think to achieve that on a wide scale, I don't know that you know, people are plugged in the sort of way that they would need to be in order to, like, pick up on, you know, what is behind, as you said, the man behind the curtain. And that's, I think, what's required.
And it's also hard to expose it, because then the trick has become, whenever, you know, you sort of shine a light on this,
right,
what they'll do is turn the tables and call you the race. Here's Sarah Palin talking about what to watch out for with the liberal media.
And we don't sit on our thumbs this next time when one of our own is being crucified and falsely accused of whatever the hip accusation of the day happens to be, right? Racism, sexism, whatever. Really, it's kind of Orwellian observing how that works, that rule of Saul Alinsky's, no doubt, that the left employs. Disgusting charges from the left that reverse them. You know, for it is they who point a finger. Not really. They have triple that amount of fingers pointing right back at them, revealing that they are the ones who really discriminate and divide.
First of all, I applaud the reference to Saul Alinsky. Who knew she knew? I mean, that was on the other hand, Ian, I mean, you talk about this too. This ability, this difficulty in actually exposing it and calling it by name.
I think this is a way of seeing that the coded rhetoric of dog whistle politics actually functions within a larger racial rhetoric on the right that goes under the name of colorblindness. Mm. So colorblindness says, hey, it's racism whenever you expressly mention race. But if nobody mentions race directly, it's not racism at all.
Yeah.
And now you can see immediately that second step ends up defending dog whistle politics, because nobody's actually said black. They just said thug, right? So colorblindness is, well, that's not racism. But notice what happens. If you say the word race as in, hey, we have serious racial divisions in this country that we need to address, that turns out to be racism. And so that's the move that conservatives are constantly making. They're constantly injecting race into our national conversation, talking about thugs, illegal aliens, Muslim terrorists, the silent majority. And yet when critics respond to that by saying, hey, actually, these are racial divisions that you're playing to, and we need to be serious about racial healing and becoming a multiracial country, the right turns around and says, see, they're the ones who just mentioned race, so they're the real racists. And that's just part of a constant sort of rhetoric that has actually been highly effective. But I think there's one clear response to that, and that is to say, you know what? Talking about race doesn't make you a racist. Pulling a fire alarm doesn't mean you set the fire. There are really problems with race, and the only way to get past them is for us to have a sustained conversation about this transition that we're making towards a multiracial democracy, and the importance of recognizing that we have shared interests across race lines in getting our country back from the very rich.
Mark?
Very quickly, to bring it close to home, you know, when there was the noose hanging here at Duke University mm-hmm. last spring, and when President Broad had finally issued a kind of public statement, he was adamant of using this language about colorblind, mm-hmm. right? To the extent that, you know, I even had white colleagues at Duke who were like, okay, what is this, right? This is such, you know, an anachronistic use of language, mm-hmm. right? Antiquated use of language, because it diffuses the fact that the noose hanging might have been, in fact, motivated by race as opposed to something else.
Well, I want to switch gears just a little bit, although not too far afield, because we've been talking about politics and media and coded language, and I want to talk about the new HBO film Confirmation. It showcases the Senate hearings for then-Judge Clarence Thomas, his nomination to the Supreme Court, sexual harassment claims brought by his former employee, Anita Hill. Mark and Natalie, let me ask you, first of all, what do you make of this film and the retelling of this story?
Having watched the hearings, you know, 25 years ago, you know, it came on the cusp of what were the significant kind of gender risks within the black community. You're talking about Mike Tyson and Robin Givens' mm-hmm. marriage. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the color purple, right? So it's mm-hmm. all these kind of tensions. And suddenly you had the prominent, visible black man and Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And again, this is also a critical moment for what we know as network cable news. The decision to broadcast the hearings live on a Friday night, this becomes really the right. beginning of the 24-hour news cycle, right? Mm-hmm. It's this idea of taking the spectacle of race and gender and sexuality, and everybody is sitting there watching this, not knowing who the players are or why they're there, but they're so fascinated right. by the drama that plays out, you know, that Friday evening back in mm-hmm. October of 1991.
Yeah. and I guess, you know, I was just graduating from college, I think, when the hearings took place. So I have foggy memories of, you know, of watching the hearings. I absolutely remember being completely on the side of Anita Hill. I just want to put that out there.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the HBO's Confirmation is interesting to me because it kind of neutralizes, I think, to a certain extent, some of the tensions that Mark just described, because What I kind of got from the retelling of these hearings is that there is, on the one hand, this very kind of docile, meek black woman who, you know, is insistent, adamant that she was sexually harassed. And then there's this, you know, righteously indignant black man who is, you know, saying, no, I did not, you know, I don't know that woman, basically.
Who's married to a white woman.
Who is married to a white woman. You know, but I kind of feel like they, you know, I don't know. I mean, media, certainly, HBO is going to tell the story in a certain way. But I just think that there, and I think it bears out in, you know, sort of the response that has come in analysis after Confirmation, that there was a lot that was left out. You know, there was a lot that we could kind of unpack that took place then.
Well, part of it is what Mark's talking about, the 24-hour news cycle, the fact that we had this not so coded but recontextualized use of charge language, the high-tech lynching, which was part of the hearings, but also the division and the genius. So to talk about the industry, the way in which mostly the business community and political forces, largely the right, had become ingenious at creating these divisions, that when you think about the appointment of Clarence Thomas as the black candidate that you as a Republican president are going to put up, it's kind of ingenious. And the divisions that you talk about played out in homes all across America. Mm-hmm. Kerry Washington plays Anita Hill in the HBO series or in the HBO program. And she talked about watching those hearings on NPR's Morning Edition.
You know, I was 14 when the hearings took place, and so a lot of my memories about the hearings are really through the perspective of my parents. And I really remember it because I grew up in a household where we talked a lot about social issues and politics, and generally everybody was on the same page, whether we were talking about a woman's right to choose or affirmative action or whatever it was. The hearings was one of the first moments where I remember them having a different point of view. You know, my dad was very pulled compassionately toward this African-American man who was having his career and his reputation destroyed by this panel of older white men and being attacked by a woman. And my mom was really pulled in the direction of this African-American professional woman who was coming forward and being re-victimized.
Kerry Washington, the actress who plays Anita Hill in the HBO film Confirmation. So the industry, the ability to fine-tune these kind of divisions, Mark, was well-developed by this time.
Yeah, and, you know, the film does a couple of interesting things. Like, I was struck by the fact that its framing of it actually was Judge Bork, or the attempt to and I forgot about that in the context. Right. So what it becomes almost is a political retribution project, right? You know, in the context of that. But also in thinking about, you know, because I'm in graduate school at this point in time, so I'm reading Black feminist writers at this point in time that all of this is playing out. And I think what's important to remember, you know, in terms of why an HBO does this, you know, Kerry Washington gets involved because Judy Smith, the character that Olivia Pope is based on, is in fact a fixer in the Bush White House, right? Her character is actually featured in the context of the film. So, you know, that's how she gets to the narrative. But again, this is a moment where we think about sexual harassment in very different kinds of ways. You know, there's a case of a very prominent Black scholar, Claude Steele, who was a provost at UC Berkeley, who just recently had to step down because he mishandled a sexual harassment case. That would have been unheard of 25 years ago, right? And so when you see immediately after the Anita Hill situation plays out, you see the uptick in women who are elected to Congress, the uptick of nationally women who are elected. You start to see legislation start to speak back to the reality and describing exactly what sexual harassment is. And you're also dealing with a generation of young folks. Right? I'm on Twitter this weekend, and there are young folks who are seeing the hashtag Anita Hill, and they're going, who is this Anita Hill that folks are tweeting about, right? And you recognize that this, in fact, is a history that has been submerged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So hopefully this creates a moment, even in the gaps in Confirmation, for folks to begin to relook at this history and begin to have other kinds of stories now. About it.
Yeah, and to, you know, just kind of bring it back to this whole idea of dog whistle politics and what Mark was saying about how even Black politicians employ that tactic, you know, for strategy. You know, high-tech lynching. I mean, that is like the phrase that we remember Clarence Thomas, you know, saying, and the imagery that invokes is so powerful. And, you know, he knew what he was doing when he said it, you know, and so it just brings home the idea that, you know, when you are in the political arena, no one is above using this sort of coded language. It's the extent to which it's used and to what end.
Well, I'm going to switch gears one more time because we're just about out of time, and I think we would be remiss if we didn't note the loss from the hip-hop scene of Malik Taylor, also known as Fife Dog, from the hip-hop group A Tribe Called Quest. He died at the age of 45. Mark Anthony Neal, what's his legacy? How important is he in the world?
Well, he's part of one of the great supergroups within hip-hop, A Tribe Called Quest, incredibly influential. You know, if you talk to Ninth Wonder and Fonte, you know, members of Little Brother, they'll talk about North Carolina's own Little Brother. They'll talk about the influence of A Tribe Called Quest. But he's also significant because, and Natalie can weigh in on this, the way that he publicly talked about his struggles with diabetes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that I guess the way that I found out that Fife was struggling with type 1 diabetes was through Michael Rapaport, the actor Michael Rapaport's 2011 documentary Beats, Rhymes, and Life, which is an ode to A Tribe Called Quest. You know, and there has been a lot that's been written about Fife's death and his struggle with diabetes, and sort of using his death as due to complications from diabetes as a wake-up call to talk about Black health and diabetes in particular. And I want to acknowledge, you know, that there are those in the Black community who were very offended by that sort of analysis in the wake of his death. Because I guess it felt exploitive. It might have felt, you know, like, let's wait some time. You know, let's back off of him. Let's not blame the victim, and let's wait for another time to talk about this. But I think that I'm presuming, and I understand that I'm doing that. But I think that's part of what Fife would have wanted, and that's part of his legacy. That's why he talked. Mark and I talked about this the other day. That's why he brought up, that's why we even knew that he had this struggle, because he wanted to talk about
it. We are out of time, but I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke. He's the author of a lot of books on the webcast Left of Black. Natalie is a professor. We could name them, but in 20 seconds, I'm not going to be able to do that. Natalie's at St. Augs, and she's great, too. And I also want to thank Ian Haney Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and his book is Dog Whistle Politics. Ian Haney Lopez, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you all. It's been a lot of fun.
For listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, I'm Frank Stachow.